All right, guys, we are back. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 152, I believe.
So, burn right through them.
Yeah, this is our second podcast, my second podcast of the day, Chud's third podcast of the day, and it's only 3 p.m.
Yeah.
So we're really cranking them out today.
You can tell I'm having a good day if I've got time to do all of that. Because podcasting, it's my downtime. It's my relaxing time. So that's good. I'm having a good day.
Yeah. You'll probably be able to get, now that the kids off at school, a bunch of the time frees up a little bit more, right?
Yeah. It pains me to say it, but man, I get so much more done when I don't have an 8-year-old following me around. Yeah. I love having him. I love that I'm teaching him and that he's like a part of this whole process. But sometimes it's hard to get feet to move and you end up having more pep talks than you do getting stuff done and things like that. So it's cool to just put my head down and go.
Yeah, I think everybody will probably identify with that has kids or has been around children. So
mm-hmm. It's an important thing to include them in stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean it makes for better work. Same with, you know, with Lanny in the kitchen. He loves to help in there, but boy, she can get a lot more done if she's not describing what she's doing every step of the way.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But other than that, I didn't do much today. I just did some cleaning up around the house and some laundry and went outside and played with the pigs for a little bit. They're pretty fun.
So I watched a movie this week.
Yeah.
I watched the new Pinocchio.
Oh, really?
There's a new Pinocchio.
With Tom Hanks.
Big fucking surprise. Tom Hanks
as Geppetto.
Yep. I'm pretty sure the whole thing is, you know, forget the old Pinocchio movie and the story and all of that. I'm pretty sure this was just Tom Hanks coming clean to say that this is what he did to his own child.
Yeah.
Because if you spell out the plot of Pinocchio, we've talked about it on this podcast and other people have too. And it's the same plot. It is about children being kidnapped, taken away to a place called Pleasure Island, where they are turned into jackasses to be returned, not as little boys. They go as little boys. They return as jackasses to be put as slaves in the salt mines. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a real, real family friendly film.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched it with my family. It's got some classic songs in it that are redone, and there's little changes here and there that are mostly for the better as far as like the movie watching experience goes. But one big difference that was noticeable to me, and it would be noticeable to anyone in our circle, but I doubt that many people even began to notice. You remember in the old 1941, there's like a puppets from around the world kind of a number. And there's a bunch of different puppets from different parts of the world that have like a few seconds, one of which are the Russian dancers who are dressed in red with the big black hats. And they do the crossed arms and kicking dancing. You remember that?
Yeah,
I remember that spot. I remember that spot really well because I really liked that dancing when I was little. I used to mimic it where I'd cross my arms and kick my feet.
Yeah.
Those are in it. But they don't reference them as Russian. And guess what colors they're wearing?
Yellow and red.
Blue and yellow.
Ukraine.
The Ukraine. They're wearing the Ukraine flag.
Yeah.
But that was fun. My whole family enjoyed it. I even enjoyed it. It was my favorite Disney movie when I was a kid, so there was like some nostalgia and all that kind of stuff. Tom Hanks is funny. Not that we're laughing with him, but I'm kind of laughing at him as he's doing this terrible Italian accent as he's a Geppetto, you know. And but then
that's offensive to me.
It should
as an Italian. How is that any different than someone doing Ebonics that's not
right
from that culture?
Exactly. And what's even funnier is if someone's doing the Ebonics, but then they occasionally just slip into total white guy voice. Well, that's what he's doing here too, because just he keeps slipping into it's just Tom Hanks, you know, for like large expressions and things like that. But then they'll write it back to the Geppetto,
It's
you
funny
know.
that Tom Hanks's last name is a major part of making sausage.
Right.
His a Hank is a package of pig intestines, right?
Yep. One Hank. It's also yarn, but yarn
Okay.
and pig intestines. Those are
Yeah.
Hanks.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, I just got forwarded an email that I'll forward to you as well, or I'll send you a link. Overseas Casings is now offering their prices to all customers. So you can buy one Hank at a time. For it comes out to be an after shipping, like $27. It's a really good deal. It's like I'm buying them in that bulk, like I was just saying, I was going to invest several hundred dollars into a few weeks ago. That hasn't worked out for one reason or another, but turns out that any of us can get that deal now.
Yeah, that's good. I'm wondering if I'm starting to second guess myself about this time the show started. I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be 3. I think I told Deborah 4, but I don't think I ever told our guest 4. But he is not here yet. So I don't know what we should do. Maybe we should pause, see what he says, and I'll get back with you. Is that cool? Okay. Sorry about that, man.
Well, there were two links. Could he have clicked the wrong link? Is he waiting somewhere else?
Yeah, I started and then I got scared that I screwed up the times and I canceled that meeting and then I sent another one.
Okay.
So we'll see. All right, guys, we're back. I totally screwed up the times with everybody, but we're all here. We all made it. We got Travis Metier here, our old buddy, making his third appearance on the show, the hat trick. And
Woo,
we got,
yeah.
of course, we got Deborah. So, how are both of you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Yes.
And
Travis, what's going on with you?
I'm doing very good as well. I'm excited to talk with Deborah, and one of my goals is to kind of keep my mouth shut because Deborah, I want to hear a lot from you today. So, I tend to be kind of a talker, but I've been listening a lot to the recent shows, and the child psychology topic is something that you had mentioned. I'm not a specialist. I'm just a dad trying to keep my shit together. And so that might be a good place to start, possibly, if that's something that interests you.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Deborah,
Absolutely.
you know what I was gonna do?
Yeah.
You can thank your daughter for saving your bacon because
You're going to fire me?
Chud X and I were gonna introduce Travis. We were gonna get him going a little bit, and then we were just gonna turn off our cameras. And I told Emily that I was gonna do that, and she got really mad at me.
I like that idea.
Well,
Yeah.
you get it because you've seen. I'm not a big talker. I'm a great listener. But
That
that
doesn't make for
doesn't
a great
really
podcast,
exactly. So
Yeah.
I'm trying to push myself out of my comfort zone.
Yeah. So, Travis, you hit me up. You said you want to come on the show. You have an open invite. And I'm glad you hit us up. You heard Deborah talking about child psychology as a topic that she wanted to get into. She didn't make it any more specific than that, you know, so we could go a lot of different ways with it. But that's kind of what she does. And you said, well, let's see, you're going through some stuff, man. And I'm
Oh,
glad you're
yeah.
coming on to share it and you're opening up to us. And you know, just to be honest with everybody, after your last appearance, I think a couple people reached out to us and were actually a little worried about you, you know. So how's everything
Fair
been?
enough. Things are actually going pretty good, and I respect that concern. It's interesting as I consider the big topic of narrative control. It's one of the things that I am very interested in, and there's so many different ways I can sort of apply that. It's easier to project onto larger entities like institutions or towns or, mayors or, something that's not you. It's easier to focus on those types of things. But as I've started my third year of not drinking alcohol, and continued to try and understand how to identify patterns that are not good and to stop those patterns so that my own kids don't continue some of the things that I was perpetrating on them. I've become very sensitive to false narratives and how parents in some ways start creating those false narratives for their own kids. And they don't even know it. The kids don't know that they're starting to internalize things that aren't true about themselves. The parents don't necessarily figure out, maybe until it's too late, that they're transferring baggage from their own BS. And so I've learned a lot as I'm going through a pretty difficult process of trying to make sure that the interactions I'm having with my own kids and the things they're hearing from me is honest, is showing like where I'm at with a process that I want to share with them, so they don't think that, you know, all the adults in their lives are just kind of damaged beyond the ability to see what's important, which is their lives and their ability to grow in this really insane sort of demonic environment that they're in.
Yeah.
How old are your kids?
Yes, that's the good question to ask. So my oldest just turned 14.
Ooh, boy or girl?
He's a boy, so he's in puberty. My middle kid is also in puberty. It's a cruel joke that he's going to be turning 12 next month. And so two boys going through puberty, and then my little girl is 6 years old. So, and I get to see them every day. And it's actually, because it is a struggle to kind of see them every day to make sure that I'm interacting with them every day, because I'm not living at home currently, but I'm still in the same town where they're at. The interactions are so much more meaningful because I value every second I'm able to get with them. And so I know how important it is just to have a consistent presence, even though I'm not there 24/7.
Were they able to go to school, or did they have to do homeschooling, or what's their current situation? Yeah.
Montana was a pretty good state to be in for the last couple of years, but they did have to go through that remote learning. And so all three of them had that challenge. And my youngest, you know, was in that formative kind of language development stuff where you really wonder what they might be missing. And so I think, you know, we got through it pretty well because we're privileged and we have a nice yard. They were able to be outside and maintain contacts with their friends for the most part. Deborah, I'm kind of curious, how many siblings do you have? Do you have brothers, sisters?
I have one sister who's 2 years older than I am.
2 years older than you?
And she has no children.
Yeah, yeah. How was the relationship with your sister growing up? I think of narrative control and kind of like stories about, you know, what was maybe put on you as you know, growing up, or your sister.
She disliked me from day one.
Really?
Yeah. And I was intimidated by her. And it wasn't until, I mean, I don't mean adulthood. I mean, like serious adulthood, like 40s, 50s, that we started to be able to just really mesh. And now, you know, I love her to pieces. I've always loved her, but, you know, we have a good time together. We enjoy each other.
Did you have two parents that were pretty active in trying to help you guys grow your relationship together, or were they kind of?
Well, my dad was not an involved parent. He did travel for work, and then when he was home, he was not really home. So mom, who was, you know, an absolute angel, did her best with what she had, you know, and, you know, I got away with some stuff. I know my sister got away with a lot more because she was smarter than me, but.
That is the exact same dynamic that I had. So my dad traveled a lot. He was more of a workaholic because his dad was the alcoholic. And so my mom did the best she could because him and he would be gone 2-3 weeks out of the month. And it's interesting because I think when you understand some of the dynamics of your own parents, it can help. And before all the pandemic stuff, I was actually at a pretty good place with realizing that my mom, her twin sister got pregnant. And so my mom also wanted to be pregnant with her twin sister. My dad is like a 21, 22 year old, wasn't necessarily ready. That didn't mean that my mom wasn't going to get pregnant. So I came along in a manner where they were both very young. And so I started, when my mom finally told me that my dad wasn't fully involved in that decision. There's a 3 months difference between my cousin and myself. I started having a little bit more sympathy with, you know, okay, if I was that young and I wasn't necessarily ready to be a dad, holy cow, maybe I throw myself into work because that's how I provide for my family. Maybe I'm not ready for the emotional side of kids. And so that is sort of the same situation that I had, where my mom was doing the best she could, but I, as the firstborn, was a smart kid and I knew how to manipulate that. And so when mom had her own set of rules, because she had to deal with two boys that were difficult, and then dad would come home pretending that he had authority, well, she let him think he had authority, but she was the real authority. And I knew how to manipulate that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it's interesting how you transfer that, because in couples therapy, when I was realizing that my relationship might not be able to continue, I realized how much of this sort of frustration I had with my mother for not maybe stepping up and semi-advocating for me with my dad in ways that I couldn't even articulate at that age, how I somehow shifted that to my own partner and then started, I think, taking advantage financially of the situation, because that's what I did with my mom. I would, you know, take money from her purse when I wanted to go buy a CD or something, right? And so the same sort of dynamics developed over periods of time with my partner and I, to the point where that emotional foundation wasn't there. We didn't have that as a strength. And so when the stresses came, you know, things are where they're at right now. But it's interesting to hear that dynamic sort of existed within your parents as well.
Well, I think it wasn't that uncommon in, yep, in my generation. You know, the dads went to work, they came home, the mom handed the martini, not really, but yeah, you know, the way they portray it on TV is not really accurate, but you know, basically, yeah, the men weren't really involved in raising the children, except for when it came time to, you know, if they needed some major disciplining, then maybe dad would take them out to the woodshed or something. But yeah.
Well, and that's the disciplining thing. So my middle child has a really difficult relationship with his sister, because there's a 4-year difference. And we were pretty conscious of, you know, as the second born child, he was, you know, pretty clingy as a baby and had a lot of needs. Of course, I'm being careful because I think of him listening to this conversation, and I love my kids. My middle kid, his name is Elliot, and he's probably the most like me. And so that's where some of our headbutting has probably been some of the biggest challenge. But the father role isn't really given the chance to be a strong authoritarian anymore. And so the conflict my wife and I have had over how we approach behavior issues with a child who really is focused on his sister in this really not a great way, but not wanting those dynamics to just be unchecked, you know? And so we've had to really try and figure out where we can find common ground with making sure our kids get support. But at the same time, I mean, we battle screens and culture that is just giving them senses of entitlement that I am struggling to find a way where I can be effective, because I know when I was told something pretty strong, I just kind of shut down and did the opposite. And so I don't want to do the same things like that, but man, I mean, sometimes I just wonder how I can effectively respond when I'm being called names by my kid in a way where I'm like, I try and explain to him, I'm like, back in the day, that would get you a pretty, pretty swift reaction.
What did he call you? Did he call you a fag?
I get called a bitch from time to time. Kid's got a mouth on him. I'm trying to remind myself the anti-authoritarian streak he has is going to serve him well down the road. So I don't want to totally, I demand respect, obviously, you know, I don't want to just be this, kind of pushover, but at the same time, I have to be long-term and strategic in my thinking, because, you know, my oldest kid, when this whole insanity started happening and I realized, to be one of the cool kids, he would probably go along if his friends were taking the jab, like he would, just because his friends were. I realized, oh my goodness, I need to find asymmetrical ways of getting at my kids. Because if they don't trust me, and if they just see like this authority figure that, you know, is just telling them what to do, then it's not going to be all that effective. It's a crazy place to try and be raising kids in this day and age. I don't know how people do it.
Really, I don't know. I mean, I'm just grateful that my kids didn't. I mean, the challenges between, you know, just the state of our world and a pandemic and and screens everywhere. I mean, it's just an unrealistic. I mean, how do they get just a normal experience?
I'm going to be the one scarring my kids. I decided if the culture is going to have all of these ways in which they're going to scar them, I'm like, well, I'm going to play my part. So I've been saying I was going to do this to my boys for a while. I'm like, I'm going to show you guys an episode of Black Mirror, kids. I'm going to show you what you need to be aware of. And I finally did it. And I think I probably picked the wrong episode. It was like the blackmail one where the kid is like doing something on the screen that he gets recorded. And then it turns into like, you better do this. And because we have the video footage of you doing your thing. Yeah. And it was effective. That I think my kids certainly was pretty impacted by it. Scarred maybe psychologically. We'll find out in counseling in a decade or so, but I'm trying to explain to them as they're already interacting with commenters on their games. You know, I'm like, hey, assume everyone is a creepy 50-year-old guy that wants to have sex with you. You know, just like, this is the world in which you're existing, guys. Like, there are so many predators out there that are grooming you. I worked at a homeless shelter for many years, and so I've seen the grooming behavior and have had to really kind of up my game when it comes to those threats that might exist. But it's crazy. And so they're watching this, they watch Stranger Things, and I make sure that, you know, they understand the actual reality behind some of these things. And, you know, they think I'm the crazy church lady talking about demonic possession, but at the same time, I think they understand there's something to all this.
If I may throw in a recommendation for you there, if you haven't heard of it, on Netflix, there's a show called Creeped Out. That it's a British, I call it the British kids version of Black Mirror.
The little kid wears a mask, right?
Yeah, it's got a mask on. Yeah, there's a little tie together at the beginning of each one with this kid wearing a mask. And he says something about, it's been a year since I watched it, but it was something about that you never know what something is until you've like removed the mask and see what it is. And it's like the first episode is a kid gets this phone. The phone that everybody has that they want so much, and the phone starts talking to them and telling them how they should dress and what they should do in order to get friends. And lo and behold, it works. And before they know it, they're completely enslaved to their phone. And all the episodes have themes that are similar to that, but you're not going to throw it on like Black Mirror and then they see someone fucking a pig. you know,
I'm not seeing Black Mirror.
That's the initial first season, first episode,
right? Yeah, it really throws you in hard on that show. There are some episodes that
it's the Prime Minister of England, or is it the President or the Prime Minister?
Prime Minister of England. That's a great
episode. My god!
Yeah. There were some episodes I did know not to show them. I still think the one I showed them was probably one of those that I should not have shown them. But at the same time, they are familiar. The boys are familiar with that. I've seen a couple of those episodes, and it gets them thinking about some of this technology that's just being thrown at them, and so. In a less scarring psychological way, but that's a good one. I have been familiar with that.
Yeah, I think the one that people in our circles talk about the most is probably the social credit score one, the one where the woman's trying to get to the wedding and she just keeps getting her score knocked down and down and down. You haven't seen any of them, Deborah?
No.
That's
Black Mirror you're referring to now?
There's one, it doesn't have any bestiality or anything in it. It's just a woman who is like, it's in a kind of this world that's ruled by technology, kind of like ours. And everything that you do is recorded. And I think you walk around and you have like a score or something above your head or on your forehead, and
it's
everything
like augmented vision. So you can see everyone's score,
everything that you do
them.
Correct or wrong. Like you have a bad interaction with somebody and it knocks you down a couple of points. And then like everybody can tell, and they're like, oh no. And this woman's trying to get to her friend's wedding. And like, she just keeps, it's this big, long Planes, Trains, and Automobiles type adventure, but eventually she ends up in a truck with another woman trucker who's just like, oh, I used to be a part of all that, and then I got my score reduced so low that I can't do anything anymore. So and she's actually real, and then they both end up in prison, and they're both just like yelling fuck you to each other and laughing because they finally got into a place where they can actually express themselves. And not have to worry about it.
I think that actress was Ron Howard's daughter too.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, Deborah, how much do you use social media still? Are you on Facebook or Instagram?
I'm on Instagram and I'm on TikTok.
Yeah. Oh, you are on TikTok.
TikToker? I look at TikTok. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't contribute. I have a couple.
I'm not on TikTok either. I heard it's the one that can really make people go down and like be hypnotized.
Any of them can. I've been getting on Facebook again just because I've been having to do research in certain ways on individuals that I'm looking at in the community and some of my journalism stuff that I'm doing. And I swear, I thought I was better at resisting this, but the algorithm is so good at showing you things that you slow down at that I have caught myself recently just scrolling for 10, 15 minutes. And I never used to do that. I mean, it's been a long time since I was sort of on the phone. That was one of my early signs as a parent that I needed to change some things. Years and years ago, I took Twitter and Facebook off my phone. I would only go on a physical computer and check that. And so I knew pretty early on that I was spending way too much time staring at some screen, and the kids were picking up on me not interacting with them. That was my way of avoiding interactions in some ways. And so, you cannot resist what the algorithm knows about you. You can't. And so I want my kids to also understand they're smart. They know they're smart. None of us are smart enough to avoid what they've developed to ensnare us. It's a real challenging thing. If you're exposing yourself at all to it, it's learning and it's adapting and getting you sucked in even deeper.
Yeah. And I'll throw in there too, Travis, that it goes outside of social media. I don't have the smartphone. I don't got one. But I don't fool myself that I'm in any better position than anybody else, because it's you can even take the social media out of it. And well, I still use Amazon. I still search things. I still am putting myself in the place of these algorithms. I do use some social media, and that's, it's no better or worse than not doing it. I think the only way that you can actually avoid any of this that we're talking about is to go full Uncle Ted and go live in the woods by yourself with no one and no technology.
Well, getting back to the idea of narrative control, I think people would have a pretty strong sense of who they are less susceptible to the advertising and the marketing schemes. You know, I used retail therapy over the years to kind of counterbalance what I felt was maybe missing in my life. And so if I was feeling sad, I'd go buy a CD back in my suburban days, for example. And so the idea of narrative control is something that I really just kind of continue hitting on, because the media that we're watching, I don't know, Deborah, if you tune into like local media, where you're at in terms of local news channels or newspapers, but what's your experience been with like what's going on in, outside your front door? What are the local media sources that you go to on a daily basis?
Well, that's been difficult for me because I've been weaning myself off CNN and those types. And now I'm trying to just hit up stuff like PBS and
Do you have like a local PBS? Like what about like local news channels or
the NBC, CBS, ABC local stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested because in Missoula, we're a pretty small market. We're 80,000 people, and we have a company called Lee Enterprises that has been consolidating a lot of the newspapers, for example. And so as I am a blogger or independent journalist trying to get stories out there in my local community, I'm trying to figure out where they're getting information already. Like we, for example, we just had a mayor selection. Our mayor died in office last month. And so city council met last night to go through a literal selection process that was outlined by state law. And it got so stuck in gridlock that they literally were talking out in the alleyway at night. That's where the decision actually was made on who was going to be the next mayor, was in the alleyway. And then to see the local reporting happen the next day, what's actually happening in local communities has been so stripped out in terms of local storytelling capacity from the media that I'm trying to get a sense of where there's an opportunity to maybe get some kind of print media going again. Like our local weekly got destroyed 4 years ago. And so in 2018, it was shut down. And so we don't even have a weekly publication that does some of the alt-weekly investigative stuff. And it means that people are very uninformed about what's happening in their own backyard.
Yeah. I'm one of them.
You guys have a pretty serious homeless problem, right? What do you follow any local reporting on the homeless issue?
No, I don't. I do not receive a newspaper any longer because it just got whittled down to next to nothing. It used to be the San Francisco Chronicle was, you know, a great paper, but it's I haven't subscribed to, or our local paper, which is it's called the Independent Journal, and I think maybe now it's like 4 pages on the weekends.
Yeah. Are you familiar with who's on your city council or who's like your county sheriff or any of that kind of stuff?
Not really. No.
Yeah. No. That is, I hear podcasters, some of the, you know, like Sam Tripley and some of the guests that like he'll have on and some of these other podcast shows, you know, because you're not alone, Deborah. I don't want to put you on the spot. You are not alone. A lot of people, especially in larger cities, aren't all that familiar with city council or who their sheriff is. And so I'm kind of unusual in how interested I am in that and how long I've been following local politics and have been kind of directly involved in a lot of that stuff. But from what I've been looking into, if you don't have a good sheriff, especially if your sheriff is the coroner, narrative control, if someone dies, like there's a woman named Rebecca Barsotti, for example, she went missing last summer. This was months after a domestic abuse charge that her, her husband was charged with in March of 2021. She ends up being found the following May. Her body was found, and I can't even begin to describe to you what is going on with this case. It is so unbelievable to me that the narrative can be controlled at this level, and it's because the Mineral County Sheriff seems to be a huge part of this corrupt small town that can literally let this guy get away with killing his wife. From my perspective, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence now.
This was in your town, this case?
This case is just west of Missoula. And so, you know, when Adam was driving through and checking out this part of the region, if you're driving west on I-90, you go from Missoula through Alberton, through a little town called Superior. And Mineral County, where Superior is the last county before you get to Idaho. Okay. So like Lookout Pass is where you go from Montana to Idaho. And Superior is maybe 2,000-3,000 people. So very, very small town, but it
fantastic,
is just,
fantastic drive.
It's a beautiful
so
drive.
So beautiful. You could go up over the mountain, windy. It's like a big windy freeway. I was going pretty fast on it in my truck. And then you get to the top and you head down and you're in Idaho. And it's like this beautiful.
Well, don't drive through Mineral County, Adam, anymore. Until a new sheriff can be found. That's not completely corrupt because there is a lawyer filing something called a writ of mandamus. I'm not a legal person. I don't know the ins and outs of all of this, but the claim is that Mineral County has gotten so corrupt that people are being pulled over for no reason, charged with crimes they didn't commit. Sexual assaults are not being investigated. It's like the Constitution no longer applies in Mineral County.
Why is that happening there?
Because from my understanding, the Sheriff's Department is that bad.
Are they that bad on purpose? Or,
well, it's so you've got to think in terms of resources. Like when you're not paying people that are risking their lives, you know, I've actually worked a lot with law enforcement when I worked at the homeless shelter. And so the boots on the ground cops, I actually have some amount of sympathy because of the stuff they deal with and the burnout and frustration they experience. And they don't get credit when actually they de-escalate some crazy person and they have a good outcome. They don't get credit for that, right?
Yeah.
I do have some sympathy for what law enforcement's going through as our mental health systems are deteriorating and meth is all over the place. But at the same time, you know, if you're not getting paid enough, you're more susceptible to off the books revenue, right? You're going to be more tempted to do a few things that are, you know, maybe at first just a little questionable, and then you justify further and further acts, you know, and a lot of the law enforcement, they're in such close proximity to the criminal element. I think it's hard for them to keep the perspective on who's the good guys and who's the bad guys, especially when you have active cartel elements that are bringing in meth and fentanyl. And if your law enforcement has any proclivities that might get them in trouble. I mean, local cops can be blackmailed just as much as, you know, national figures can be blackmailed. And so I think there's a lot of those types of things that happen. And over the generations, you get worse and worse stuff going on. I mean, I feel like all of our institutions are sort of deteriorating in ways that makes it more susceptible to that kind of corruption. Yeah. But I think you should go to city council every once in a while, Deborah, and check it out, you know, just sit there and soak in the municipal experience. You know, it can be pretty boring, but it can also get exciting sometimes.
It'd be interesting to find out who your sheriff is, Deborah, and what his thoughts are on the state of the world, the state of lockdowns. You know, people talk in our little world about, like, we just talked to John Bush from Freedom Cells, and he was talking, you know, he talks about exiting and building if you live in a bad place. A lot of people, like libertarian people that I talk about going, especially during the heavy duty lockdown part of this last couple of years, they were talking about going governor shopping. And I don't think people need to go to different states. We talked about this as well earlier today. I think you can find as much freedom in unfree places as you can in supposed free states. People need to sheriff shop. I mean, that is the real deal. I live in Columbia County, Oregon, and height of the lockdown, our sheriff put out a letter to the governor of the state and the people saying, like, there's no COVID mandates being enforced here. And, you know, some people went along with it. I mean, I navigated the whole problem with the air without a mask everywhere I went. I was asked in one place in my whole county to wear a mask one time.
Yeah, we had that same issue here, Adam. Our sheriff was actually really great on COVID, on lockdowns, on masks, all of it. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter at all, because that's not what the people cared about.
Right.
So all the businesses still followed their own rules. They would say they were following other rules and that they had no choice. And you'd say, well, Bill Elfo says this, that's our sheriff. And they'd be like, I don't even know who that is. Who are you talking about?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's surprising to see, because there is a election coming up for it, and someone's running against him, you know, and it seems like a somewhat, I don't know if it's contentious, but it seems like a competitive race, because there's a lot of, I mean, people, it's something that people here pay attention to. And I kept seeing all these, like, Instagram ads for this guy Terry Massey, who's running against him, and every time it was up, they talk about, like, how he wants to put more cops on the streets. You know, he's a law and order guy, young guy. And I would always just say, what is his, I would write in the comments, like, what's his opinion on lockdowns? Will he enforce lockdowns in case of another pandemic or something? I never get an answer back or anything like that. So I don't know. I'll probably vote in that election. I'll probably, unless I find anything else out about the old guy and the new guy, I'll vote for the old guy, you know, just because of how he handled the last thing.
There's this idea now that's sort of out there of the constitutional sheriff. And our local newspaper has a article that came out a few days ago about a sheriff in a different county. I think it's Sanders County. And they're like, oh, he used to be associated with the Oath Keepers. Woo. And like, he's doing what he wants to as sheriff. And it's like, well, you know, a lot of sheriffs have a lot of leeway, it seems like, to enforce or not enforce the laws. And I ask about homelessness, Deborah, because this is where I've seen in our little community some pretty interesting stuff of non-prosecution and non-enforcement of laws. Like, when I worked at the homeless shelter, I was very involved in this area around what's called the Reserve Street Bridge homeless encampment area. And so it's a very widespread area with a lot of different encampments. And the Montana Department of Transportation has been trying different things over the years. They put up this fence, for example, And I told the guy, his name is Bob Vossen. I call him Soccer Ball Bob because his job is to get kicked around like a soccer ball by people with more power than him. And so he doesn't answer the phone anymore when I call. But Soccer Ball Bob was told by me that the fence wasn't going to work.
What about Beach Ball Bob?
Maybe that would be better. That's colorful, a little bit lighter. It's going over the volleyball net.
Yeah, that could, you can imagine the homeless people pushing him around, you know, like at a ball game.
Here's the thing. So I was part of a camp cleanup on Thursday of last week. And having been directly involved in these types of cleanups, I used to message weeks ahead of time that this was happening. If it was an active campsite, we wouldn't touch it. You know, we would actually say, we're just here to pick up trash. But because we did it twice a year, they weren't building structures out there. I left my job in 2016 and the hands-off approach took hold. And so there's a registered sex offender that's been living out there for 3 years. I did not know the plan was to take apart his vast living structure. And so that wasn't communicated to the volunteers. The sheriff's department, Missoula County Sheriff's Department, they showed up early that day. They trespassed him from his house. He left and then he came back, right? They detained him temporarily on the sidewalk above the encampment. And for whatever reason, they decided to just let him go and drive off. So he found a vest to blend in. He climbed the bulldozer, started punching the Department of Transportation guy in the face. He threw a rock at another guy. And by the time I got out there, he was swinging this metal pole around. So 911 was called. The sheriff deputies come back. And luckily, they don't tase or kill him. They just arrest him because he calms down. And but I'm left in this situation of like, hey, we have these tools to deal with people with mental health crisis, right? Not only that, but that same day, all of our local officials that were supportive of all these homeless services were actually getting together to say, here's why you should support the $5 million mill levy on the upcoming ballot. And so as they're on the county courthouse downtown saying, give us $5 million voters. Meanwhile, the Missoula County Sheriff's Department was just letting some sex offender go ape shit crazy, you know, on Department of Transportation staff. And I'm like, hey, I don't think the things that you say we have, we actually have or are being used on the ground. I'm a big fan of like talking about reality on the ground, not just the rhetoric that our politicians and like nonprofit leaders talk about. And so it's been very interesting in terms of narrative control to say, this is the reality. You guys have let a sex offender live there for 3 years. And then you thought in one day you were just going to come and like, you know, say, all right, time to go. Like, no, this guy actually was defending his home because you gave him the impression that he was supposed to be there. And so it's a real challenge in terms of getting some of this reality out there because the media is not telling the story, or if they do, it's very limited in what they're able to share.
Was that like a sanctioned area under the highway where they were?
No. So part of why nothing is happening in this area is because District 9, actually, I think the court in San Francisco was the court that upheld the Boise decision that said, unless a community has alternatives, you can't kick someone out of their illegal encampment. Well, Missoula has opened up all kinds of shelters. We have an indoor shelter and an emergency winter shelter. We have the transitional safe outdoor space, which is a bunch of tents. And we have another outdoor encampment. So we've created a bunch of these encampments. Part of it was through COVID money. And so now the idea is you can enforce the illegal encampments because we have official encampments. But a lot of people, they don't want to live in the official encampments. There's drama. There's private security that act like Mexican revolutionaries wearing masks on their face. It's really kind of absurd. Meanwhile, there's just drug abuse and there is mental illness. And there's word that cartels are already sort of a presence in this area. And so it's a bit frustrating. I also push back on the idea that it's only mental illness and addiction because during a previous cleanup this spring, there was a second story treehouse that was built and there was a bunch of walkie talkies in the trash. And so there's an organized criminal element that exists among these homeless encampments. And that's pretty obvious to anyone that understands the reality on the ground. So it's something that makes me worried for my kids.
Recently in Portland, there's been a lawsuit filed by a bunch of handicapped people under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, who they're suing Portland because they can't use the sidewalk.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they're saying, like, under the ADA, like, you're letting all these people live on the sidewalk. I'm handicapped. I can't get down the street, you know?
Fair enough.
So we'll see what's that. Hey, Deborah, you know what I saw recently from your county was a video of two San Rafael cops.
Yeah,
beating the shit out of this poor Mexican landscaper.
Yes. Yeah.
What's going on with that?
Well, I have not been home, so I have not seen any news, and I'm sure it has not been in the news. Well, I don't know. But the story is that he and some of his friends on Friday evenings would, you know, park their cars someplace, you know, not in an urban area, but someplace.
Where were they? Down in the canal or something?
Probably. Yeah. I don't recall exactly where, but it looked like open space, like you know where. Anyhow,
the guy's just a normal.
They just meet there Friday evening, crack open a beer, you know, shoot the shit.
Yeah, and they said they'd get a little bit loud and rowdy sometimes at their apartment complex, and the people would say, right. "Hey guys, can you?"
So they
go down to this area where there's nobody at, and they drink.
Yeah, so they're not disturbing anybody, and they're just having some beer. And it was a woman and a guy, if I'm not mistaken, police.
A Mexican woman and then a guy, a white guy.
Yeah. And they just brutalized this guy.
She's being really, really disrespectful to these guys. They keep telling him, give us your ID. And he's telling him, I want to give you guys my ID. I got to stand up to get it. It's in my pocket. And he's speaking English, but it's not hard to understand what he's saying. And he keeps standing up. And then they keep like yelling at him to sit down and all this stuff. And then finally the guy just like take him down. The dude's a big guy. He punches him in the nose, like square in the nose, puts him in like a headlock and like punches him in the nose, blows up his nose. And then they put him in the car, you know, arrest him. Then the other cops show up and they like, it's just so horrible watching these cops just talk about what they did to the other cops and like laughing about it and stuff. I imagine those guys are going to get, what's that?
Who recorded the footage?
It's body cam footage.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah.
And I imagine these guys, it's surprising that it wasn't erased. I don't know. I mean,
for some reason
they figured they weren't going to get in trouble for it or something, but I don't know. I think a lot of the times when they like talk about it, like so freely like that and laugh about it at the end, that means like, I think they're nervous, you know, and maybe they're trying to play it off like it wasn't that big of a deal, but I imagine they're probably going to get in pretty big trouble for that. And
this landscaper evidently has a lot of clients who really, you know, like and respect him and came to his defense. So there may be some follow-up to it because, you know, some of his clients might.
It's interesting. I like to try and when I interact with law enforcement, which I don't do too frequently, but just having been living downtown, I have a lot of interaction with some of the chronic homeless people. And so I've had to call 911 a handful of times recently. And one of the things that I've realized is that when I throw sarcastic remarks about our county attorney not prosecuting people with mental illness, I get a lot of smiles from law enforcement and a lot of knowing nods because I'm trying to see where there might be some ways of getting into their world a bit, their understanding of how things are operating on the street, because that description that you gave sounds like, you know, a culture that exists that, you know, brutalizes people probably somewhat regularly. You know, who knows what's beyond that, but I know that a lot of law enforcement is burned out. A lot of people that are sadistic kind of gravitate towards that job. But I think there's just so much wrong with that culture, and they really can't share much outside of that culture. I mean, I've been able to see behind that a bit just from working at the shelter and having so much interaction with law enforcement. I've heard some of the gallows humor that's pretty awful when you actually hear some of the things that fire guys or some of the first responders are saying. And I know a guy that I talk to every once in a while who works on a local truck, ambulance truck. And he said he sort of takes the people that he's working with that, generally speaking, and says there's two groups. There's the people that, you know, the group that really wants to help and save lives. And then he calls the other group the eugenics group, that are trying to speed up the process for some people that they're tired of dealing with, you know? And so it's the systems are breaking down. And I think that's something to focus on, because the humans inside those systems, that's part of what they're reacting to. And not to justify any of that violence. I just know that when I got burned out myself, I was reminded, I think today or yesterday recently, by someone that I hadn't seen in a while, why I left my job. And it was because my burnout was causing me to want to control situations more than I actually should be trying to control them. And so when I saw a guy brandishing a machete out on this island, instead of just leaving the situation, I took a few steps forward to try and like talk to him, because I knew him and I was going to take control of the situation. And my volunteer was like, Travis, you need to back up. Like, we don't need to be dealing with that. Let the cops deal with that. And so burnout and that vicarious trauma, that idea that people in first responder positions take on some of that trauma and crisis, is a real thing. And something that I think people need to get opportunities to work through. Otherwise we have burned out cops and burned out ambulance guys and fire guys. And that can lead to some pretty terrible behavior.
Yeah.
I just looked, Deborah, if anybody wants to see that video, it's on the police's Instagram page.
Yeah.
It's San Rafael, California. So
yeah.
Well, hey Travis, to speak on the narrative control in conjunction with child psychology. You know, I think there are a lot of times where parents control narrative with their kids in ways that are unhealthy, that people don't really even think it is at the time. You know, like a really good example is the family dog dies and you don't tell the children. You say, oh, they went to live on a farm, right? Or maybe like a bigger version of that would be the children are told that dad is a workaholic. And that's why he's always gone, because he's a workaholic. But in reality, behind the scenes, they're splitting up and they don't want to tell the kids that. They want to, you know, maybe they're just hoping, hey, no, we're going to work this out and he's going to come back. But really, he's staying in a hotel two cities over, three blocks over, I don't know, away from there.
Maybe he's staying in the Motel 6 in Missoula.
Right. But then you tell them, no, he's just busy. He's working too much. So he's got to travel all over. And it's just this lie. It's a flat lie that they're telling the kids, because they're trying to save the tender hearts of the children.
The children's
hearts are tender. But then the divorce actually comes, because that separation, you know, didn't work out. And now they've been under the impression that dad's always working for a year. And then suddenly it gets dropped on them. Okay, kids, we have to come clean. Maybe they'll even say that, we're coming clean with you, we're getting a divorce. And it just seems to me that that's going to have such a more severe psychological impact on the development of the psyche of the kid than if they were to understand the hard truth of that mom and dad aren't getting along. They're not getting along so much so that they don't want to be in the same house.
Yeah. And I think it's difference in our brains. Honestly, I think parents have this long-term thinking where they're so worried about what that difficult conversation might mean in that moment. And long-term, they don't necessarily know that kids are pretty resilient and they can handle the truth more than what parents sometimes give them credit for. And also they know bullshit. And so when you bullshit them, they know bullshit. So when my dogs died, the boys, I didn't have my girl at the time, but they saw mom and dad cry. They got to say goodbye to the dog. They knew that the dog was being put to sleep, you know, because we wanted to end the suffering of the animal. And I had the conversation, you know, directly with them about the divorce. And it was one of the most difficult things that I could have possibly done, but it was a direct conversation. And my partner and I were both in the room, and it happened quicker than I wanted it to. But you're not sparing them.
Yeah.
You're not protecting
them. Yeah. You're not.
The reality is going to hit at some point, no matter how much you control the narrative. And, you know, we could expand that out, as we kind of have been with social media and the news and outside them controlling the narrative. It only works for so long until people see what's actually happening. But, you know, even I, you know, I can't even think of any examples anymore because it's been a long time. But when I was like, 15 to 20 years old, I could go on to friends about how my parents lied to me all the time about small stuff, just little things that now when I look back as a parent myself, I'm like, you know, I kind of get why they were lying, in quotes, lying, because they didn't have time to always answer all the little kids' questions. Sometimes you have a lot of questions and they just start going along to get along, which I do at times. And I have to catch myself if my incredibly bright 8-year-old son is telling me how he sees the power grid to work, because he's looking at these wires and he thinks, or he'll out of nowhere tell me how he thinks the internet works, and that this box is pulling it in from the air and then it goes out on this cable and then we get it into our computers this way. And it's not the way I'm led to understand that it is. Sometimes if I'm busy, I might just want to go, yep. And let that be the case. And because maybe I don't even understand it. So it's hard for me to then explain the proper narrative. And then I allow them to almost just make up their own narrative and then just say, yeah, you're right. I'll validate you, because they want validation. So we just allow that. But then that's how, I can't remember good examples from my childhood, but a lot of it had to do with vocabulary. You know, I would say, is this the word for this? And they'd just say, yes. And then later I would use that word when I'm 20 years old in front of friends. And I know, because my mom told me that's what it means, that's what it means. And they go, no, that's not quite it. And I think that we as a whole, as parents, we often accidentally control the narrative in ways that are unhealthy.
Yeah. However, I do have to say on the flip side of that however you're raised, that's your normal. And, I didn't have a great relationship with my dad. Like I said, he traveled and he was gone frequently. And, you know, he wasn't a good husband and he wasn't a good dad. But when I would go over to my friends' houses, you know, I'm talking about like when I was in high school or whatever, and their dads would sit with them and have a nice, you know, conversation or, you know, show any affection or anything like that, I thought, that's weird. So whatever, you know, as a kid, what you're brought up with, that's your normal.
Yeah.
And, I don't know if my situation was unique. I doubt it was, but.
But one of the things that thankfully did not exist in your time, Deborah, is that social media measurement of everyone else's artificially happy pictures that you think represents their actual real lives, when basically everyone's just lying to each other through the best pictures and filters possible.
Today you look at families and go, yeah, they have got it together. Those people, they have got it. You know, everything's, they have a perfect life. No, nobody does.
Well, one of the things that's been a trigger for me is what will the neighbors think? And so knowing that that was a big thing in my mom's consideration, like she still to this day has to have the greenest lawn, and she loves it. She takes pride in her lawn and she works her butt off to keep that lawn nice and green, you know? And so that's something that she takes pride in, but it's also something she felt a deep obligation to keep up with in suburbia. Cause I spent a lot of my years in Kansas City, in the suburban part of Kansas City growing up. And so suburbia was such a frustrating place for me to kind of grow up in, because it seemed like everything was always just status measurements among, you know, all these, you know, suburban obnoxious bratty people that just were always trying to one up each other. And all of it was sort of hiding depravity behind these nice surfaces. Right. But I think, you know, I don't know, it's difficult to measure yourself by other people's lives, because what you do grow up with is what is your normal. And but I think also to give yourself some grace in my, you know, as I'm trying to kind of figure out why, you know, I'm in this kind of situation I'm in, you know, even though it's hard for maybe parents to express love, it's so critical, if you can, to just even some physical affection, you know, because the neglect can have a huge impact. And it's a weird one, because when you're experiencing like physical abuse or something, you know what, you know that it's abuse, right? And I'm not going to say that I was abused at all. My parents were actually kick-ass parents for the most part. And I do have a lot of understanding on the fact they did the best they could. The other part of narrative control, I think, is value and what you actually take as, do you have value? Do other people value you for who you are? That's another big hangup that I've been trying to examine is, what is value? Because, you know, I think sometimes providing monetarily can be a stand-in for emotional support and maybe, okay, great. So we got a nice house and we grew up with, I was never, you know, hungry, always had material needs met, all that. But I wonder now that I'm not working a paid job and that, you know, part of my, I think, breakup with my partner is that she had the money and I didn't necessarily. So she had a little bit more of the financial resources. So as a man, I had that chip on my shoulder, you know, what am I valuing myself or what value does society have for me? And I'm a writer. And so I want some validation with what I'm writing, but I got turned down when I tried to get back in the university arena for writing. And so I've had to kind of go through a lot of what is value? Do I have value myself? Am I trying to work on myself so that I don't have to look to other people to give that value to me? Right. But it's a process and it's difficult. And I think that, you know, talking about what Chud was kind of explaining, you know, some of the things that we put on our kids, one of the frustrations I see is the unrealized dad who never, you know, did what he wanted to in sports and wants to push the sports thing on his kids. That is so fucking so obnoxious. Like, stop it, dad. Just stop doing that shit. You know, if your kid wants to play the sport, support him playing the sport. If he doesn't want to play the sport, don't push that. I will say I won't let my kids play football. I like their brains too much the way they are. And so that is one thing that I kind of put my foot down. I was like, I don't want you guys playing football. But those are some of the ways that I think, I'm kind of rambling a bit, but it's interesting. Someone else talk for a bit so I can stop rambling.
You think, if we get into that sports thing, I disagree with you a little bit there, Travis.
Oh, good.
I played a lot of sports growing up. I wanted to play football so bad. My parents wouldn't let me because I was, you know, I was sub 100 pounds as a high school freshman.
Okay.
Yeah. But like they finally let me, I played soccer. I played competitive soccer. I was good at it. I hated it. They finally let me play football in eighth grade. I like immediately got injured
What position did you play?
You know, whatever little guys play, wide receiver and cornerback, you know?
Yeah.
But then in high school, I played 4 years of high school football and I played safety and wide receiver and I returned kickoffs and punts and stuff like that. And I didn't get to play much, but I was really good at special teams. I'd like run down and smash into, but I was fine with it. My favorite players was always like Scott Case and Bill Bates and like Steve Tasker, like all the, like the guys that were defensive backs, but special teams specialists, you know. That's just a little bit about me, but
so organized sports, are you kind of going in like the kids might need a little bit of structure type direction?
I do think that, yeah. I love playing baseball is a big deal in my family. My dad was like real good, played, you know, in college. And my father and I really connected on that. He was gone a lot, you know, he's an 80s dad, you know, he's in wrapped up in that whole, you know, 80s, you know, materialistic whole keep up with the Joneses, look good on the outside thing. My parents were good parents though. And my dad every spring, you know, cut back his work. He worked so hard. He made a lot of money in the 80s. And he was a smart guy. He's a college graduate when that would actually like get you a high paying job. And he, but he, every spring he was gone most of the time. He was, you know, he got up, he left for work at 4:30 in the morning and he got home for dinner at nighttime. And then when he got home and he had like a home office. And then, but every spring he would cut down on his workload and he coached baseball from the time I was in T-ball all the way until, you know, seventh or eighth grade. And then even like when I was in high school, he'd come out. We butted heads through that real hard, like when I got older and he was like hard on me, you know, because he wanted me to be good and he knew what I was capable of and I didn't always live up to his standards for me, which were high because he knew what I could do. He knew how to get the best performance out of me. But then like in high school, he'd come out and he'd hit hit fly balls to the high school team when I was still doing that. And I really enjoyed having him around for that in like not an authoritative position.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, and then they made me play soccer, which I didn't like doing it. I was decent at it. I didn't like doing it. But I think if they would have given me the choice for any of that stuff, at some point or another, I would have. I see it with my sister's kids too. They just quit. They just don't want to do it one day and they just stop.
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be, you know, listen to their reasoning and stuff like that. But I don't think like a 6-year-old kid should be able to get to make their own choices like all the time when it comes to things like that. Cause I think of especially nowadays with what you guys have to fight with screens is a little kid is always going to choose dessert first, you know, so just like a chicken.
I agree with you wholly there, Adam, with the exception of maybe if I was understanding Travis right, you know, like I understand the idea that you say you have to do a sport. You have to do, and maybe you could even go, you have to do a team in quotes oriented thing, which wouldn't necessarily come off as sports. Music could be that because you have to play with other musicians and things like that. And I can see telling your child you have to choose a
extracurricular.
An extracurricular activity that you must do and you must stick with it. Once we've signed up, you can't do a week of soccer and then say, no, I want to do baseball instead. You know, there's some lessons about follow through and things like that that are there. But I think it's a real bad situation if, like, I always wanted to be a baseball player, but my kid wants to play soccer. And I'm telling him, no, you can't play soccer. Like, you know, if I force him in, or maybe I let him play soccer too, but I just force that baseball and force it and force it and force it because I want to see him make it into the minor leagues like I never did or something like that. And that's not so good. And as I'm listening to this and thinking about it, there's a much worse version of this. Like if we all agree, yes, team sports are good. It's that pushing your own image upon your child that I hear Travis talking about with that you're trying to make them into, I might be pushing on my kids that I want them to be farmers, right? Or other people might, instead of team sports, they want their kid to be a lawyer or be a doctor because that's what our family does. And you're trying to funnel them in one direction where you're going to be disappointed in them if they don't turn out a certain way that you think about or that you think that they should. Now, in 2022, guys, what is something that someone might force upon their child in this manner that would not be okay by my own standards? And that would be like a gender assignment.
Yeah.
That would be, you know, I have an aunt who never had kids. Thank the Lord. Because I've watched her try to push homosexuality on multiple kids in our family. And by push on it, I don't mean anything really fucked up, right? Like I'm not saying sexual situations, but from childhood, she's asking, wouldn't you rather play with the Barbie doll? Because she's a very liberal progressive and she has always wanted to tell people that she has a gay nephew or, you know, something to that. Like it's clout for her.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
it's funny, but
it's not.
It's absolutely not.
It's awful. Affluent white female liberals. Awful. Well,
what Adam was touching on is really, really important, I think. And Chud, you also kind of hit on what my perspective was more like the unrealized dreams of the parent being pushed on to the kids. So, but I'm actually open, even though I used to be pretty liberal and pretty anti-war, for example. But on the flip side, I would be open to some kind of year of mandated service, whether that's service in your community or, you know, some kind of like National Guard. I would actually be open to that for maybe a 17-year-old, 18-year-old before they go, you know, to other things like college. I'm not going to necessarily encourage my kids to go to college if there's not a really good reason for them to. But, you know, I did a year of service through AmeriCorps Vista. And I see a lot of value in some kind of structured requiring some kind of structured extracurricular activity, forcing them in some way to interact with other kids, and let them know that, like, hey, you got to deal with it. Because my middle kid is already developing this kind of, I mean, he watches too much of The Office, I think. That's how he's basing a lot of what the world is like. The adult world is on watching The Office. And he watches a lot of The Office, but and he's like, I want to work in an office like that. And my kid, that's not the that's real world. No,
that's working in a cubicle in Scranton, yeah. Pennsylvania is not fun.
He thinks it's hilarious.
But at the same time, like he's already struggled in some of the interpersonal stuff at school. And, you know, he finally had this situation that I knew was going to, at some point we were going to be talking to teachers. And so there was an opportunity for my partner and I to sit down and talk to the counselor. And that's where I got the sense of how really smart he is and how he's really measuring himself against the other smart kids. And he's very competitive. And so now he's getting more into soccer and he's getting more involved in some of that competitive stuff where it's a little bit more constructive and not so so dependent on his identity. You know, I think it's finding that right balance where you're not pushing something for your own agenda or your own purposes. You're actually looking at what they have the aptitude for and the love to do, and then finding ways of encouraging that. Even if they want to maybe give up, you say, no, it's worth following something through, because if you let them give up, you create quitters, and our society is full of quitters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And what Chud said is the main point. It's like once you commit, especially to a team, you're there till the end of the season.
Yeah.
And remember like in high school, I was having such a hard time my senior year of football. I wasn't getting to play at all or anything like that. And there was people that I was better than that were playing instead of me because their parents owned large wineries and I wanted to quit so bad. My dad's just like, I'm sorry. I know how you feel, but you're on the team until the end of the year and you don't have to do it. But
at least he acknowledged your feelings.
Yeah.
You know, he said, yeah, I understand how you feel.
Yeah. But the rule in my house was like, especially when I got to high school, the rule was if you're not playing a sport that season, you have a job. So I don't know. I think that I thought that was a fair trade off, and I liked it. I found a good workaround to it. I found a job that was Saturday, Sunday, so I only had to work 2 days a week. And
well, realistically, I would throw a job in on that team sport aspect that you have to learn to work with other people. You have to learn to work by other people's rules. I mean, that's a big thing in sports, is that you don't get to make up the rules. The rules are written down and we don't get to, we're not compromising on the rules. You're either out or you're safe. It's not up for, I mean, maybe there's some interpretation, especially in major leagues. Well, was he or not?
Well, maybe even nowadays, like every kid gets to stay on first now or something like that.
Yeah. I don't even want to think about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the same thing in a job. If you want to keep the job, you have to be there at 8 o'clock, and you have to, if you, you know, maybe you can get away with 8:05 a couple times, but then they're going to tell you if you want to keep this job, you need to be here at 8 o'clock, and you don't get to choose when you go home. You go home when you go home, and you don't get to, you know, if you're, say you're working in a wood shop and you're just sanding stuff, you just have a sander and you stand there and sand. Real easy job. Great job for a kid. I would highly recommend it for any child. And, but you can't sand against the grain. You're not useful to them if you don't. So you like, and you have other coworkers. So it's got all these aspects that are a part of team sports. I would be just as much for my sons having a job as I would having a sports team to be on. And it doesn't matter what those are, as long as they're doing one of these things.
Yeah, I started working when I was 15. My oldest is already, you know, he does the dishes and gets paid for it. And he wants to do a good job. I mean, I'm like, where did this work ethic come from? I'm glad. I don't know if I can take responsibility for instilling that in him, but he wants to work and get money. He doesn't like the shortcuts. He wants to make sure that he's, you know, getting paid for what the work was actually worth. And so, but yeah, working when you're young is really important. I told my kids that, you know, I've worked in restaurants. And in a restaurant, the dishwasher job is just as important as the person out on the floor. And if you're working with a good team, a dishwasher or a restaurant job can be a lot of fun. But right now what's happening, you know, people just don't show up for work. I went to the bagel shop the other day and it was closed because no one showed up. They just don't show up. And it's like, is this a generational thing? What is going on here? Is this like a COVID thing? Like what is happening? Because there doesn't seem to be the sense of work. I mean, this victim mindset has gotten so pervasive and it's so debilitating to a person's, again, their worth. I mean, it feels good to work and get paid money to work.
Yeah, I think it's so many things colliding together at this point. And I don't have to work anymore for the time being. And so I'm in there too. I didn't want to go to work. I didn't want to show up to work. And I think that's a whole different issue. I think kids not showing up to work is a product of free money and COVID and all this stuff. But I just think people see like the world as it is today and they say, why am I going to show up for even $20 an hour to do it? $20 an hour for 40 hours a week doesn't do shit for me. You know, like I'm just going to be like, why even do it? You know?
Another thing with the homeless situation that people don't understand is that even the subsidized housing they're offered, that's still a huge chunk of their, a lot of the folks that I worked with had disability checks. Right. And so it's like, why do they want to not live in housing? Well, sometimes to keep that whole disability check, that whole $800,000-$900,000, it's not a whole lot, but if they have that control of all of that and they're living in a tent down by the river, well, maybe that's their choice. You know, but the ways we're forcing people into these structured living situations, if they don't want to do it, how do you actually force that? And I get kind of translates with my kids a little bit. If they don't want to do something and really put their foot down, you know, it's like, what are the methods of leverage and coercion you can actually levy to get the outcomes that you want? Because you're not given as many tools as a parent these days to sort of coerce behavior. And so it just seems like, overall, we've had this softening of work ethic and sort of the ability to kind of carry through on a task. And it's been left to the technocratic bureaucrats to just do a shitty job in the meantime as everything sort of deteriorates. I don't know. It's hard to track what's happening in this day and age.
Yeah. I like to try to think back on people, generations that raised the next generation that raised the next generation. So like, you know, like teenagers now, who are they being raised by Gen X and then largely by millennials, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Millennials and the younger Gen Xers like myself were raised by boomers. And, you know, boomers were raised by some people that were probably so deeply traumatized growing up and just like had like no love or affection or compassion. I don't know how it was, but I don't know. I like to try to think of what the cause is. And, you know, we talked about the fourth turning on a show a little while ago, and I like to add that all into it. So.
Cause that's a huge part of it. I heard you guys talking about that, being on the fourth turn, and how these cycles work, these bigger cycles. And it definitely seems to be pretty accurate when you see the reality on the ground. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It's boomers did, you know, my parents are both boomers, and I think I got to live in the 80s and 90s, and I got the best boomer upbringing as possible. Cause I am a fiercely independent person. And I don't like being bothered. I don't like being told how to do things by other people. And that's, you know, just based on, that's just how I turned out. But it was because I didn't have my parents hovering over me at every turn, telling me what to do, where to go, how to play with a toy. You know, I was left home alone at 8 years old, you know, my parents gave me some microwave popcorn and some Crystal Light and the TV remote. And that was good enough back then. And that's great that I got to do that. Then they told me, you can't watch TV right now. You got to go outside and play. And then, you know, I was able to come home by myself, but then they were also there to give me guidance and watch over me and to tell me that I needed to do my homework and to check my homework. And when I was in high school, say, no, you can't go to continuation school and do all that stuff. Cause if I was allowed to, I ended up being a big screw up. And if I hadn't had them, I would have been an even bigger, like crazy person on the streets of Missoula, Montana person, like without my parents, you know?
Yeah. You got plenty of guidance, but you were also left to your own devices to make your own decisions and work it out. You know, it was you're kind of you and me, like we're kind of at the end of that. I'm not sure. How old are you, Travis? Are you about the same
I'm
age?
Turning 44 this month. So really very close to Adam, born in 78. So the end of Gen X.
And I'm 40. So I'm the beginning of the millennial.
Yeah.
But then shortly after that, we started getting what a lot of people refer to as the helicopter parenting.
Yeah.
They're always hovering, as you put it.
That were was you, me.
You were a helicopter parent.
I'm sure I was. I mean, I was terrified. I wouldn't let my kids play in the front yard unless I dragged a chair out and sat there and watched them. I was so afraid. I just had this irrational fear that they were going to get picked up and stolen from
the milk carton. You were part of the generation that started seeing that milk carton, you know, Johnny Gosh. Yep. That fear that was, I mean, it's a real fear too, that kids were being snatched up on the streets. But, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting when we think about, you know, our different generations growing up, you know, Deborah, San Francisco and the whole musical culture of what came out of California, you know, I was hugely impacted by people like Jim Morrison until I started understanding, well, I started reading books like Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon.
Yeah.
And that just broke my brain.
Broke my heart.
So you have a similar feeling about the music that a lot of people loved from the counterculture days being different now from the information that we have about them.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the kind of music that you were into growing
sure,
up?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm almost 70.
Oh, wow.
So, I grew up with 60s music and 70s music and, you know, Free Love and, you know,
everybody in that book is who you loved.
Everybody in that book, I absolutely loved and still do, but it's sad now to have a little different perspective on that. But
well, it is, because my kid is now listening to music. He's at that age where he's growing it. My oldest is growing his hair out, starting to listen to music, actually looks at my iPod every once in a while and starts, you know, taking songs. And I don't want to influence that part of it that much, but I have a new respect for good music and what I found value in, but also music that I actually probably got caught up in that had a not so good effect. I remember distinctly Marilyn Manson, Antichrist Superstar, realizing that listening to that album in my basement was making me depressed, and I stopped listening to it. And so now that I see some of this stuff, and after listening to all the conspiracy podcasts I think a lot of us consume, you know, I get very concerned about the stuff that they're being exposed to. And I actually had finally some of the sex conversations with my boys. And it was because Billie Eilish gave me this amazing opportunity to talk to them about what I'm afraid for them experiencing. And essentially, Billie Eilish was on Howard Stern and talked about how she feels that her nervous system was hijacked by the pornographic material that she started getting exposed to at the age of 10, 11, and 12. And so I don't, unfortunately, you know, necessarily know what my kids have already seen in terms of some of the social media. I know there were some older kids on the bus, I think last year, that maybe showed my middle kids some stuff that maybe, who knows, but like, it's terrible that a parent like myself can say that they're not even sure what kind of explicit content their own kids may have come across. But, you know, I at least started that conversation with, hey, pornographic material is actually debilitating to your chance of having a healthy sex life down the road. It's like, and it's not an easy conversation to have, obviously, but I am so worried that the amount of material that they're going to get exposed to is just going to really take away their chances of having a healthy partner, you know, and a healthy life that's satisfying. That's one of the most screwed up ways that we are messing up our kids.
It's very sad.
Is that we've normalized pornographic material to such a degree that that little demon show, that FX new show, Little Demon, about the Antichrist.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the preview. I should actually probably look into it and see what it's all about. But
it's
that's
awful.
What is it? I'm so writing that down.
You go, Travis. You tell her about it.
Danny DeVito is like, I think the main sort of actor voice of the devil, but it's like the Antichrist is a female. So the future is female. Glad to know. And it's basically this cartoon from the, Damon. What's that guy's name? The creator of Rick and Morty.
That guy's a pedophile.
He's had some explicit material himself, some jokes about doing things to babies that he's been called. Dan Harmon, I think, is the guy's name.
Yeah.
And so this new show is just awful, but it's getting advertised and marketed everywhere. You're seeing ads on primetime, you know, as football is getting going again. My oldest loves watching football. And so it's these kind of shows.
Is this marketed to kids?
It's a cartoon. So, I mean, that's always going to catch a kid's eye.
I watched a preview type thing, and it did not appear to me to be something they would be marketing at kids. It would be in the what do you call it, like adult animation,
Adult Swim kind
of. Yeah, Adult Swim, Simpsons, animated program for adults.
Yeah.
At least that's what I took away from it.
That distinction is getting harder and harder to make, I think, for all these different streaming platforms. I mean, TV was such a different creature back when we were growing up, with a fixed time that something was being shown.
Yeah, you couldn't watch something that your parents didn't want you to watch because you were in bed at 9:30, and it came on at 10, you know?
And if you did watch, if it was during the hours and you had it on, your parents would walk through and say, "No, I told you can't watch this."
Yeah.
For that matter, if you did watch it, you'd see one episode, as opposed to now, if you're able to watch it, you can, binge watch 375 episodes if you got the time.
Well, and the impulse control and the immediate gratification that we have baked into the cake of childhood is really just insane. And adults themselves are so new to these technologies that they can't provide enough boundaries for their own kids because we ourselves don't have those boundaries in place. And so, if that new show comes out, yeah, you want to binge watch it. The fact that it's even called binge watching, binging is not a good thing, whether alcohol or media, it's all kind of problematic. But at the same time, I found that honesty is one of the best things to do when it comes to the kids. I don't bullshit them. Even finally being able to tell them about my cannabis use was really kind of, it was relieving for me because I knew my oldest had probably already run across it. He already probably smelled it. And so he already probably had some questions, and I wanted to make sure that he heard it from me first and that he knew if he had questions, I wanted him to talk to me and not just, go and get information elsewhere, because even cannabis now has been so weaponized with the potency and some of the devices that are being used. I can't even say that cannabis is a generally harmful substance anymore because of what they've done to it. So vaping, all these new technologies in substance abuse that's come online, it's like, oh man, even cannabis is kind of problematic in a lot of ways.
Getting hijacked.
Well, and Chad, I heard you talking about some of the frustrations with drug culture as you guys were trying to have some of the social opportunities during the pandemic times, and how it kind of started becoming like drug scene-esque.
Right. Right.
That's pretty frustrating.
Which, isn't ideal. I mean, it's similar. That's on its own. I don't mean to change subjects, but like, I just watched this documentary, the Anarchists. Adam recommended it to me about Anarcho-Polco. I don't know if you're familiar with that, Travis.
A little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, it was an interesting documentary series. But overall, at the end, I'm like, yeah, what do I care about any of this? Because all this is they're degenerates that want to abuse drugs. everything that those groups of people were into was massive drug and or alcohol use. And it's kind of like, I think I can kind of leave that stuff behind. But it's interesting you say, talking about your cannabis use with your kids. I told my son that I use cannabis, and he just doesn't believe me. he's like, no, because he's seen it portrayed on TV.
Right.
And he's like, you're not that guy. You're not that stupid, is kind of what he's saying, because he's seen
stoner.
Yeah, right. I don't come in with a bag of Doritos and a bong or whatever it is that he's picturing. But yeah, it's a wild world to navigate that kind of stuff with your kids.
Well, I when my children were very, very young, I vowed to myself I would never lie to them. And if they wanted to know something, I would answer it truthfully. And of course, you know, there came
How long did that last?
It did last. I remember Emily asking me, Adam's wife is my daughter, Emily, how old I was when I first had sex. And I did not want to answer that question at all, at all. But I did.
That takes guts. That's not an easy question to talk to your kid about, for sure.
Yeah, I wasn't
like in the 40s.
Well, you know,
backseat of a car.
I don't think there would be anything wrong with you not answering that question. What I think is more important there is that you not deceive. So if you hear that and you go, "Oh, I was 26 and that's when I married your father." That would be a lie, right? But like, for instance, I started drinking way, way, way too young. And if my son asked me when I started drinking, if I told him and he were to go, "Oh shit, that's only a couple of years from now." Whoa, cool. I could start drinking in a couple of years from now. I don't even want to let him entertain that thought.
Yeah.
Right. So what would be wrong is if I say I waited until I was 21 and I showed my ID and I got my first beer. I'm not going to tell him that, but I might tell him I'm not going to tell him. I might tell him I won't answer that question until I think that you're ready to hear the answer. And then I could say legally it's 21. That's how old you need to be before you could get in trouble if the sheriff sees you. So, you know, I'll give him answers, but I just can't in good conscience tell him the real truth for myself until he's maybe even past that age. And I say, I started drinking before you because you haven't yet. That might make him go, "Oh,
I'm behind."
Or hope I would only say it if I know his psychology is that he's going to go, "Oh, because I know I'm not really ready yet. I want to jump the gun. And you started doing this before." Then, okay, I'm listening to you. I'm listening to your reasoning behind that, because it's not just something you get to do when you get to do it.
Yeah, I'm talking to my middle kid, especially about alcohol use, because he's already like saying, "Well, alcohol doesn't taste good and I don't like alcohol." And I'm like, "Yeah, well, it's the effect that you get dependent on." And I told him, I'm like, the fact that I've had alcohol abuse issues, that I'm struggling with, and that my grandpa had the same issues. I told him, I'm like, you have a higher potential of getting dependent on a substance like alcohol, but I also know he has to experience things. He's the kid that touches the hot pot, after you tell him not to. And so making sure that you just have as much of a trusting relationship as you can, so that when they fuck up, in whatever ways they're going to fuck up, they call you, so they don't make it even worse by trying to like drive home or hide it from you. Yeah. That's where I'm hoping I'll have that honest relationship with them established, so they can feel like they can tell me that kind of stuff. Because, the peer pressure and the need to be with your friends and do things to get acceptance from that peer group is so strong. It's the biggest pull I see now. And I knew it was going to happen, but to actually see that start developing and to have that pandemic develop at the same time, where you realize that your influence was almost like a life and death matter, and that you were losing that influence to, some snot-nosed 13-year-old that might be the cool kid that my oldest wants to listen to. I'm like, "Oh, wow. I need to step it up." But you don't want to like have that self-fulfilling prophecy where you plant a seed too early and they get a sense, "Well, dad did it at that age, so it's okay for me to try it." You want to try and protect them and let them be kids for as long as possible. I mean, there's such a rush to age them and mature them beyond their age. I want them to enjoy being kids as much as possible. And that's where my love of Legos comes in, because I am a huge fan of Legos. And the fact that my 14-year-old now still plays with Legos to some degree, I'm very happy about that. And I'm hoping I can kind of bring in Legos as part of my narrative control approach, because I have an art studio here in a building downtown Missoula where it's actually kid focused. So they do a lot of after school programs and a lot of cool things for kids. And so an art therapist that has a studio here also, I'm going to start talking to her about incorporating Lego play into her art therapy approach and to see what we can do to get kind of Legos going, so I can maybe have an actual business that I can enjoy doing something. Because right now my journalism doesn't pay me. It just kind of puts a big target on my back because I'm exposing some powerful people that don't want to be exposed. So Legos is a lot more entertaining and possibly lucrative, because everyone loves Legos, right?
Hey, you know, I think Legos have come up every time we've talked, Travis. And
probably.
I don't think I've mentioned either how much I love Legos. I loved them when I was a kid. I really wanted to do them when I was in my 30s and didn't have kids.
I really wanted to do Legos.
But I just couldn't. I'd would tell Lanny, like when we were first married, I'd say, I'm going to go buy some Legos. I don't care. I'm going to go do this. And then I'd see the prices and I'd be like, you know, it's a little expensive. Yeah. And I got into these ones called nano blocks that were little tiny Legos that were pretty fun. Ooh.
Oh, wow. Let's see. That's impressive.
So it's kind of, it's hard to see, but this is my,
That's impressive.
That's my current build. It's a giant Lego city that I'm hoping can become something that's going to be like a mixed media narrative delivery device is what I'm calling it. It is so much fun. And I have invested some money in Legos. That's a lot of money.
Check this, man. Oh, go ahead, Deborah.
I was just going to ask, is it on something that you can transfer it around, move it around?
I kind of built it and then realized I'm not going to be able to get it out of the doorway. So I'll have to be creative in how I change it, or I have to move it at some point probably. But when I talk to people and I kind of get on my rants and I'm talking about some of the local stories, I see in people's eyes when they want to escape my conversation, they want to get away from me. I'm usually pretty self-aware because I can come on strong, especially if I've had a lot of coffee. But I have actually seen the shift. If I bring the topic to Legos, they light up and start listening again. They connect to, like, if they've had any experience as a kid with Legos, it connects to that, you know, joyous, playful part of their brain where they're like, yeah, Legos.
So when I was in my early 20s, I had an older guy say the word Legos, and I've ended up using this analogy my whole life, and I use it with my son all the time. And I've seen a lot of people really connect when I talk about Legos, as I most commonly do now. I was working in a shop and there was a plumbing issue, and I was told I needed to fix this pipe. And I said, I'm not a plumber, I don't know how to do it. And he said, it's all Legos. It's just Legos. And I went, okay, I didn't really understand what he was saying, but I did by the time I fixed that situation, right? And I started expanding that out. A friend of mine was having some trouble with his car like a year later, and he thought that it was something he couldn't fix. But I looked at it with him, and I was showing him what I thought he needed to do. And I said, dude, it's all Legos. And he went, oh yeah, it is. This is within my grasp. And I use it all the time, especially with younger guys. And I use it with my sons as well, too. Like when a task feels overwhelming, most of those tasks have multiple parts to them. Mm-hmm. And those parts are always as simple as Legos. Not always, always. There are exceptions to this, I'm sure. But
break it down into the small. Yeah.
Once you see it, and once you can see a project as Legos, then all of a sudden everything becomes like doable. There's nothing that's just goes completely outside of your ability to do it. If nothing else, especially today where everyone has a digital camera, take a picture, start taking things apart, maybe take a few pictures as you go. And like, you can't go wrong. As long as you look at it as these Legos, you're taking it apart and you're going to have to get it back. It looked like the Eiffel Tower. You're going to have to bring it down to nothing, and you're going to have to bring it back to the Eiffel Tower.
Yep. Yep. Trying not to get overwhelmed by the largeness of what might have to be done. You break it into smaller parts so you can actually accomplish it. That's great. I love that.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's an important part of my life, is not even the actual Legos, but the
concept.
The analogy, the concept.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love that. especially where I'm at right now, of like having to put out so many fires of things that I have no idea what to do. It's all Legos and it's all on YouTube, you know, like, that's the title of the show. So
it's all, Legos.
I think that's a perfect place to wrap this up. What do you guys think? I'd love this. This has been a great chat, Travis. And I'm happy to see your, I don't want to say you're a little disturbed last time, but you seem to be doing much, much better. And it makes me happy. So.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you reached out, because I, in thinking back, I was in one of those sort of, I think, caffeinated, manic, kind of like, shit in this town is going crazy, and I'm living in a David Lynch movie, and I might like be taken out at any moment by actual like crazy psycho people. So yeah, no, I'm in a better place. I think I've definitely seen the path out of that, and Legos is part of that. So I think that's an excellent place to wrap up. And Deborah, I'm so glad I finally had a chance to talk to you, because that
same here, Travis.
I've really wanted to chat with you. I can't tell you how much your conversations with Adam have meant to me in a time period that was absolutely crazy for all of us. I think you don't know how much your impact has been for the people that have been listening over the hundreds of episodes you guys have done. So I thank you so much for making yourself vulnerable in this way. I love being able to talk. So
I am very grateful to hear that. I appreciate everything that you've said.
Oh, Deborah, I'm proud of you. You talked today. See how much more fun it is when you talk. I just got to get you. This is seeing you get to talk about being a parent means so much to me, because you're such a wonderful mom.
You've raised
a beautiful family, and you know, as much as your daughter makes me angry and I want to blame it on you sometimes, I love all you guys, and you've done a great job with your girls, and
thank you.
And
despite all the mistakes I made, they somehow turned out to be really great people.
The mistakes that you've made, there might be some mistakes you made that I get upset about sometimes, but I know that every mistake that you made had your daughter's best interests in mind, you know, as weird as that sounds. So,
well, yeah, I mean, you know, we love our children and we want whatever, you know, the best for them, happiness and health. That's the main.
Amen to that.
All that's important is your happiness and their health.
I respect everybody up here as a parent, and thanks for letting me tag along as the one childless person up here. So hopefully someday I can join your guys' ranks and ask you questions in the future. But Travis, do you want to tell everybody? You got to get that podcast up and going again. Do you want to tell everybody where they can find you?
Yeah, so I do write pretty regularly at my blog, and that's zoomchron.com. So ZOOMCHRON. So I put out usually 6 articles a week, but it's mostly local stuff about Missoula. And then the podcast, I'm definitely going to hopefully in the next couple of months get all my technology kind of back up and going. And then you can check out Engen's Missoula if you want to know about the esoteric implications of tax increment financing. There's a website for that. It's engensmissoula.com. And I think I have a Substack, but I haven't really updated that in a while, but I really love the opportunity to come and just have a good conversation with good people. And so the chance to kind of promote some of the stuff I'm working on is an extra bonus, but really just the conversation today has been so, so excellent. I'm so happy. So thank you so much for having me on, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. I've been feeling a little bit uninspired lately to do the show, and this might've rekindled the flame. So thanks for, this was a great talk. I really, really enjoyed it. And, yeah, like I said, open invite. I know that you won't abuse that. You'll hit me up in a couple more months when you find out some weird, cool stuff, and we can talk about it then. So,
yeah.
Thanks for joining us. Hope it doesn't get too cold too soon up there, but I know it's coming. And we appreciate you as a member of the Deborah Gets Red Pill family, man. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Chud, do you have any final words?
Nope. I'm good with this.
Great. All right, guys. We love y'all. It's all Legos.
Legos. It's all Legos.
It's all Legos.
Right. Peace, guys. We're out.
Bye.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people or those black babies. Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass. Delay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order are idiots. Playing God all day. Deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that seven-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're going to be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.